Welcome to Base by Base, the papercast that brings genomics to you wherever you are. Thanks for listening, and don't forget to follow and rate us in your podcast app. So, what happens when the human body's cellular garbage disposal system completely breaks down?
Oh, that is a terrifying biological scenario.
Right, because your cells are generating metabolic waste continuously, I mean, every second of every day. But imagine if a highly specific type of that microscopic waste just stopped getting cleared away.
Yeah, it doesn't dissolve.
Exactly. It doesn't pass through your system at all. It just starts piling up relentlessly inside major organs, you know, swelling your airways, embedding into your joints. It causes this massive cascading systemic failure.
And the wild thing is, we aren't talking about some massive failure triggered by a new pathogen or some complex environmental factor.
No.
We are talking about the absence of a single highly specific microscopic protein, just one missing piece of the genetic puzzle. And the downstream mechanical consequences for the patient are, well, they're completely devastating to their quality of life.
Today we're going on a deep dive into the real world consequences of missing that one specific enzyme. And more importantly, we're looking at a really fascinating way researchers are biochemically engineering a replacement.
Yeah, a replacement to literally step in and clear out that cellular trash.
Right. So today we celebrate the work of this collaborative Korean team who have significantly advanced our understanding of enzyme replacement therapies for rare genetic diseases. This was a massive undertaking led by Young Bae Son, Aram Yang, Min Sun Kim, and, you know, the rest of their team across multiple institutions.
Right. Places like Zhu University Hospital, Samsung Medical Center, Kangbuk Samsung Hospital, and GC Biopharmacore over in the Republic of Korea.
Exactly. And the clinical problem they're tackling here is mucopolysaccharidosis II, or commonly known as Hunter syndrome.
Hunter syndrome, right, which, as a quick refresher for those following rare genetics, is an incredibly rare X-linked genetic disorder.
Meaning it mostly affects males.
Yes, precisely. Because it sits on the X chromosome, it predominantly affects males. We're talking about an occurrence of roughly 1 in 100,000 live births. And the root cause is this mutation in the IDS gene.
The IDS gene, which leaves the body drastically deficient in the enzyme iduronate 2 sulfatase. Let's try to visualize the mechanical failure happening here. Let's look at the lysosome.
The recycling center.
Right. Since you're listening to a genomics deep dive, you already know the lysosome is the cell's recycling center. But let's picture it as like an industrial waste management system for a city.
Okay, I like that.
The raw materials coming into the plant are these complex biological molecules that the cell is just done using. So the iduronate 2 sulfatase enzyme is, it's like a highly specialized acidic chemical solvent.
Right, a solvent designed to break down one specific type of material on the conveyor belt.
Exactly. So building on that industrial analogy, without that specific solvent, those undissolved materials just totally jam the entire conveyor system.
Yeah, and in Hunter syndrome, those specific materials are complex sugars called glycosaminoglycans.
Or JAGs, right.
Specifically, we're looking at heparin sulfate and dermatan sulfate. Now, normally these sugars are crucial, right? You need them for building connective tissue, skin, blood vessels.
But when they're spent.
When they are spent and cannot be recycled, that raw material just piles up. The machinery grinds to a halt and the physical footprint of the factory begins to swell.
And that swelling, you know, it doesn't stay localized to just a few isolated cells.
Yep.
Because these GAGs are accumulating everywhere, patients experience a cascade of really severe physical symptoms.
It's extremely severe.
We see massive enlargement of the liver and spleen. The clinical term is hepatosplenomegaly.
Right.
Plus, you know, profound skeletal abnormalities as the joints literally stiffen up.
Yeah.
And furthermore, as the dermatan sulfate embeds into cardiovascular tissue, it causes the heart valves to physically thicken and fail.
Which obviously leads to severe impacts on heart health and basic physical mobility. It really affects the whole system. Now, there is a spectrum to Hunter syndrome. The severe form manifests very early in infancy, and unfortunately, it often leads to progressive cognitive impairment and early mortality.
But the study we're analyzing today focuses mainly on the attenuated form, right?
Exactly, the attenuated form. In this form, there's minimal neurological involvement, which allows patients to survive into adulthood.
Right.
but their bodies are still fighting this constant, just exhausting battle against this accumulating cellular waste. They desperately need some kind of external intervention.
And for a long time, there was really only palliative care. But then came enzyme replacement therapy, or ERT, where a recombinant, you know, a lab-made version of the missing enzyme is infused directly into the patient's bloodstream.
Yeah, the standard treatment, which is a drug called idursulfose, the brand name is Elaprase, that was actually approved way back in 2006.
Right, but this new deep dive is looking at a study testing a next-generation recombinant enzyme. It's called idursulfase beta, brand name Hunteris, and it's administered via weekly intravenous infusions at 0.5 milligrams per kilogram.
So the researchers here are evaluating the phase 3 efficacy and safety of this new idursulfase beta. And I have to say, the way they designed this trial is just a fascinating study in overcoming the unique regulatory constraints of rare disease research.
I'm so glad you brought that up, because I want to pause on the trial design right here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because when I was looking at the control group, something just didn't add up for me. I was reading through the methodology, and I noticed they compared their new drug to a placebo group from a trial done all the way back in 2006.
Ah, the TKT-024 trial.
Exactly, the TKT-024 trial. Why rely on 15-year-old historical data instead of just running a concurrent placebo group today? I mean, wait, they didn't use a concurrent control group. How is that scientifically rigorous or fair? It seems like a massive, unnecessary variable.
I know, it looks highly unusual on paper. But you have to consider the clinical reality of treating a progressive, fatal disease.
Okay.
Since 2006, we have had an approved, working treatment on the market, the original idursulfase. If a research team today runs a trial for a new treatment, the medical community considers it an absolute ethical barrier to take a patient with a fatal rare disease and randomly assign them to receive placebo.
Oh, wow, I hadn't even thought of that.
Right, you cannot ask a patient to let their organs continue to fail, literally withholding a known life-saving therapy, just to serve as a clean statistical baseline for your new drug.
Yeah, I hadn't considered the ethical barrier of withholding an existing cure. That makes complete sense. But from a purely mathematical data-gathering standpoint, how do they satisfy the regulatory bodies?
It's tricky.
Right, because how do you prove this new drug works better than the natural progression of the disease if you can't actually measure the natural progression of the disease concurrently?
And that is exactly the brilliant part of their two-part study design. They needed to use that 2006 historical placebo data to prove efficacy. But they had to prove it was a valid, mathematically sound comparison first.
Because they can't just assume, right?
Exactly. They couldn't just assume a patient in 2025 responds the exact same way as a patient in 2006. So part one of their study was a double-blind 52-week bridging test. They took 20 patients and randomized them to receive either the old 2006 drug or the new idursulfase beta drug.
Wait, so meaning no one is left untreated?
Nobody.
Every single patient in part one is receiving an active working enzyme to clear the cellular waste.
Correct. The entire goal of part one was strictly to calibrate their methodology. They needed to prove that their baseline clinical results for the old drug matched the historical 2006 trials results for the old drug.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, by running this bridging study, they proved that their current patients on the old drug reacted the exact same way as the patients in the original trial. It validated their entire testing framework.
They are essentially calibrating a new scale using a known standard weight before they start measuring unknown items.
Exactly.
Once they establish that their new scale reads the exact same as the 2006 scale, they can confidently compare the new measurements. That's so smart.
Right, and once they cleared that rigorous scientific hurdle, they moved to part two. They added 12 more patients, all receiving the new idursulfase beta, bringing the total to 24 patients.
And these were all male, all Asian, with a mean age of around 12 years old, right?
Yes. And this was an open-label test for 52 weeks. Because they had already validated their framework mathematically in part one, they could safely and accurately compare these 24 patients receiving the new drug directly against the 32-patient placebo group from the 2006 historical data.
It's a masterclass in trial design for rare diseases. So let's look at what they actually found when they ran the numbers through this validated framework. The primary endpoint they used to measure success was the 6-minute walk test.
The 6-MWT, yeah.
Mm. Which, you know, I've always thought of the 6-minute walk test as less about leg strength and more like a full body check engine light.
That's a great way to put it. It functions as a highly validated clinical proxy for integrated health. It's a submaximal exercise test, meaning it doesn't test absolute peak athletic performance. It tests functional capacity for daily living.
Right.
When you ask a patient to walk for 6 minutes, you're simultaneously testing their cardiovascular endurance, their respiratory capacity, and their musculoskeletal function.
And for a systemic disease like Hunter syndrome, where the GAG accumulation is damaging everything from heart valves to joint mobility, a single walk test captures the holistic impact of the therapy.
Exactly. And the results for the new drug were just striking. Over 53 weeks, the patients receiving idursulfase beta added an average of 62.2 meters to their 6-minute walk test distance.
Wow.
Yeah, that represents an 18.19% improvement in their mobility.
To put that into perspective for you listening, adding over 60 meters in just 6 minutes means these patients are walking with significantly less mechanical resistance in their joints and significantly better oxygen delivery from their cardiovascular system.
Right, and contrast that physical improvement with the historical placebo group. They only improved by about 7.3 meters over the same time frame.
That's a massive difference.
Huge. The new enzyme was vastly superior to the natural, untreated progression of the disease. And that physical improvement on the outside is a direct reflection of the biochemical victories happening on the inside.
The researchers tracked the biomarkers in the patient's urine, right?
Yes, specifically looking for those complex sugars, the GAGs, that build up when the recycling plant breaks down.
And the numbers there are crazy. In the treated group, urine JAG excretion plummeted by over 70%.
71.13% to be exact.
Yeah, so the cellular trash didn't just stop accumulating. The massive backlog was actively being broken down and flushed out of the system. Meanwhile, the untreated historical group saw their waste burden increase by another 20% over the year.
Right, the raw material just kept piling up on their factory floors, increasing the toxicity.
Mm-hmm.
But the physical relief this flushing process provides to the major organs is profound. Liver volumes in the treated patients shrank by over 26%.
26%.
And spleen volumes reduced by a similar margin. That clears up the massive hepatosplenomegaly we discussed earlier. And shrinking the liver by over a quarter is not just a structural or cosmetic win, it has cascading benefits for the entire torso.
Oh, absolutely. Because when the liver is massively enlarged, it pushes up against the diaphragm, literally restricting the lung's ability to expand downwards.
Right.
By shrinking the liver, the drug physically gives the diaphragm room to move again, which directly improves the patient's ability to just take a full, deep breath.
The mechanical connections within the body are incredible when you view them through that lens.
Definitely.
Now, both the old 2006 drug and this new idursulfase beta are recombinant enzymes designed to replace the exact same missing piece of the genetic code. Yet the data shows this specific new version works incredibly well.
And the reason comes down to a highly specific detail in the biochemical engineering of the enzyme itself, which is the part of the methodology that totally fascinated me.
Let's get into it.
The new drug, idursulfase beta, is produced in a specific cell line. They're called CHODG44 cells, and they use a serum-free media. Let's explore why that manufacturing environment actually matters. Like, how does swapping the cell line and dropping the serum change the resulting enzyme's performance in the human body?
It requires a bit of a dive into protein expression. Mm-hmm. So CHODG44 cells are Chinese hamster ovary cells.
Right.
And they have been specifically engineered to be deficient in a certain metabolic pathway, dihydrofolate reductase. Without getting too lost in the weeds here, this deficiency basically allows biotechnologists to force the cells to massively overproduce a target protein.
Okay, got it.
And when you grow these highly engineered cells in a serum-free medium, meaning a nutrient bath that doesn't rely on animal serum, you remove a lot of the biological variability in competing proteins that naturally occur in serum. So this highly controlled, optimized environment fundamentally alters how the cells build the enzyme, specifically changing its glycosylation pattern.
Meaning the cells are attaching sugar molecules to the enzyme in a different, more favorable arrangement.
Exactly.
This helps the enzyme fold correctly and interact optimally with cell receptors. And this unique manufacturing process leads to a crucial structural difference: a higher formoglycine content. Let's unpack formoglycine, because it isn't something naturally coded directly by DNA, is it?
No, it is a post-translational modification. Inside the cell's endoplasmic reticulum, an enzyme converts a specific cysteine residue into formoglycine.
Okay.
In this specific therapeutic enzyme, formoglycine acts as the crucial active site. It is the literal catalytic machinery the enzyme uses to hydrolyze or break apart the sulfate bonds in the accumulated cellular garbage.
So going back to the recycling plant analogy, if the enzyme is the specialized chemical solvent, the formylglycine is the active acidic compound within the solvent that actually dissolves the jam.
That is exactly right.
And the new idursulfase beta has a formylglycine content of 79.4% compared to just 68.1% in the older drug.
A significant jump.
Because it carries a significantly higher concentration of this active catalytic machinery, it demonstrates much faster cellular uptake and far greater overall enzymatic activity. It simply dissolves the waste more efficiently at a molecular level.
Increased efficiency is vital. Okay. But, you know, whenever we introduce a lab-made biological product into the human bloodstream, we have to monitor how the immune system reacts.
Right. Immunogenicity is a major hurdle in enzyme replacement therapies.
Because the body sees this new helpful enzyme, but fails to recognize it because of the genetic deficiency. So it often flags it as a hostile foreign invader, producing antibodies against it.
And the patients in this study did develop antibodies to the drug.
They did. But the critical metric, however, is the presence of neutralizing antibodies, or NABs. Right. These are the antibodies that actually bind to the receptor binding domain of the drug, or directly to its active site. They physically prevent it from entering the lysosome and neutralizing its therapeutic effect.
Right, because if the immune system neutralizes the drug, the recycling plant just jams up again.
Exactly. But the data revealed something highly counterintuitive here. The presence of these neutralizing antibodies didn't actually hinder the clinical effectiveness of the drug over the 52 weeks.
Wait, really?
Really. The patients still saw the same improvements in their walk tests and massive reductions in their JAG levels.
That's fascinating.
And even more encouraging, the rate of persistent neutralizing antibodies, meaning the immune system continuously fighting the drug week after week, was dramatically lower in the new beta group.
Yeah, I saw that. Only 16.7% of the beta group developed persistent NABs, compared to a massive 62.5% in the patients taking the older drug.
It's a huge difference.
That is a massive leap forward in the long-term safety profile. The immune system is essentially tolerating this new formulation, you know, inducing immune tolerance over the course of the year.
Right. Now, acute adverse events did occur, primarily minor skin rashes during the infusion process.
Mm-hmm.
But the clinical teams managed these easily.
By simply slowing down the rate of the intravenous infusion, right?
Yep, slowing it down and providing basic symptomatic treatment. The life-saving therapy didn't need to be halted, which really proves the therapy's overall safety profile.
Now, every study has its limitations, and keeping a critical eye on the data, I noticed a quirk regarding the lung capacity measurements.
The FVC data.
Yeah, the researchers tracked forced vital capacity, or FVC, which is a key clinical metric for lung function, but the data didn't show a statistically significant difference between the treated group and the historical placebo.
Right, and it raises an important point about the reality of running clinical trials with pediatric patients. We have to remember that 80% of the cohort in this study were growing children, mostly around 12 years old.
Right.
The forced vital capacity measurement requires a spirometry breathing test. And spirometry demands very specific, forceful, and highly coordinated breathing techniques.
Yeah, I mean, trying to get a 12-year-old kid to breathe perfectly into a tube on command for clinical grade data is notoriously difficult.
It's nearly impossible sometimes.
Many of the younger kids simply had trouble complying with the strict mechanical requirements of the spirometry test, which obviously resulted in highly variable, noisy data for that specific metric.
Exactly. But given that their 6-minute walk test distances improved so dramatically, their overall cardiorespiratory function was clearly getting better. The strict spirometry data was simply too skewed by patient non-compliance to prove the lung improvement statistically.
It's a classic example of clinical realities interfering with clean data collection, something trial designers just constantly battle. Looking at the global relevance of this trial, we touched on this earlier. All 24 patients in the treatment group for this new trial were Asian males, yet the 2006 historical placebo group they mathematically compared them to was overwhelmingly white.
Yes, you have an entirely Asian treatment cohort being calibrated against a mostly white historical baseline. And the fact that the baseline disease progression and the treatment efficacy matched perfectly during that part one calibration phase, that is a fantastic scientific finding.
It really is.
It strongly suggests that this drug and the underlying mechanism of the disease itself does not vary significantly across different ethnic populations.
Right. The missing enzyme causes the exact same cascade of waste buildup regardless of your genetic ancestry. And providing this highly optimized recombinant replacement works universally. It really highlights how fundamental these metabolic pathways are to human biology.
Absolutely. So to distill everything we've explored today into a central takeaway, hydrosulfase beta is a highly effective, safe enzyme replacement that successfully steps in for a missing genetic piece. By utilizing a manufacturing process that yields a more efficient, higher formal glycine version of the missing enzyme, it rapidly reverses severe organ enlargement and restores vital mobility for patients suffering from mucopolysaccharidosis II.
It is a profound intervention for a devastating systemic condition, literally replacing the broken tools in the cellular recycling center.
It really is. And it leaves us with an incredibly exciting question for the future of genetic medicine.
Which is?
If optimizing the manufacturing environment, like using serum-free media and CHO-DG44 cells, can increase an enzyme's active catalytic machinery so drastically, what does this mean for how we might re-engineer other existing biological treatments to make them faster, safer, and far more potent?
This episode was based on an open access article under the CC BY 4.0 license. You can find a direct link to the paper and the license in our episode description. If you enjoyed this, follow or subscribe in your podcast app and leave a 5-star rating. If you'd like to support our work, use the donation link in the description. Now stay with us for an original track created especially for this episode and inspired by the article you've just heard about. Thanks for listening, and join us next time as we explore more science base by base.
I've been carrying a weight I can't explain. Miles inside me, but I'm still in the same place. Fluorescent lights and a pulse on the screen. Waiting on a change in what my body keeps. Then the clear line, steady in my vein. A small repair in the crowded chain. If the cells can't take it, let it in. Maybe I can rise again. 52 weeks, one more breath in my chest. One more step that feels like less of a test. Wash it out, break it down, let the shadows lift. When the stored up tide finally starts to shift, I'm walking farther than I've ever been. Walking into the light again. Numbers on paper, but I feel them move. Less ache in the hours, more room in the room. The silence swelling starts to let me go. Like doors in my body opening slow. I know there's risk in every new start. Signals can flare and defenses can spark. But we watch the waves, we measure the fire. Hold to the course, take it higher. 52 weeks and the future's in reach. Stronger legs under the same old streets. Wash it out, break it down, let the fear unclip. When the heavy inside finally loosens its grip, I'm walking farther than I've ever. I'm walking into the light again.